Welcome to Roundtable Talk, a podcast about longevity, senior services marketing, and the quality of life as one ages. Roundtable Talk is brought to you by Pavone Group and Varsity, a senior services agency focused on helping clients win the mature market. If you like the fresh perspectives we deliver in each episode, please give Roundtable Talk a 5-star review on the podcast service of your choice. Hello, and today on Roundtable Talk, we're talking about something that shows up in a lot of families, especially as parents age. It's the role adult daughters often take on behind the scenes to keep everything moving. Our guest today is Dr. Allison Alford, author of Good Daughtering and a researcher focused on family dynamics and caregiving. Her work shines a light on the often invisible work that daughters do to support their parents and families. Dr. Alford, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So you use the term daughtering in your work, including your book, which we'll talk about shortly. What does daughtering mean?
Yeah, daughtering is meant to be an active representation of what it means to be an adult daughter in a family. Just like we might use active terms like parenting or mothering or partnering, it gives us a sense that being an adult daughter in a family is an active way that women show up. So daughtering is the often invisible emotional, mental, logistical, and identity labors that women do in families to stay connected. And often women are doing so much more than they realize until all of a sudden they feel burnt out.
That's a great point. Interesting. So your book, Good Daughtering, really shines a light on the invisible emotional and logistical work that daughters do, particularly as they're supporting their families as the parents age. What led you to focus on this idea and eventually write the book, Good Daughtering?
Yes, I have it here. I have my bright pink book here, Good Daughtering, which is, you know, it's a book for women to read, but also their spouses, their partners, their brothers, their sons, anybody who loves a woman, it's a book for you. You know, it was over 10 years ago, I was in graduate school and I was working towards my PhD. And when you're working towards a PhD, you're reading a lot, you are thinking, you're trying to think what has been studied and what hasn't been studied. And I was noticing that there was a lot of research about women in families as mothers and how mothers show up for their daughters. But there wasn't anything there about how daughters are also active participants. And, but I looked at my own family and I come from this beautiful matriarchy of women. My grandmother was a single mom and raised three little daughters, all, you know, went and got her education and got her bachelor's and master's degrees, all while being a single mom and struggling with poverty and, you know, the social issues of that in the 60s and 70s. And I was noticing and thinking about my family and thinking everybody plays a role. And it's not just one way. It's not just that everybody's receiving mothering, but the daughters, the aunts, the sisters are all showing up in their role in an active way. And I didn't see that represented in the research, in the literature that I was reading. And so I thought, well, if it needs to be there, I better write it. I better be the one to write it. And so if I'm going to write it, I have to go study it. I have to go ask women, what does daughtering mean to you? So the culmination of over 10 years of research, talking to hundreds of women, publishing academic research. I'm a professor at Baylor University. It really all culminated in like, let's bring this together in a really readable book. Because sometimes the academic research, you know, that PhD people do is not very readable. It's dry.
And
it's
I was going to say, we could probably use the word dry.
Yeah, it's not very accessible either. You can't always click on it and get to read it because it's behind paywalls. And so I really wanted to make a concise and readable book that's for real women and men who are in family relationships and just want to think about how can I support the women who are doing daughtering in my life?
That's great. So why do you think that the work of daughters historically has been so invisible or unrecognized? Yeah, it's is it more invisible, do you think, than the role of the son in the family or the male counterparts?
So much interesting discussion there. You know, one of the reasons why daughtering is invisible socially, in society, in culture, and in families is because we don't have the words to describe what it is that daughters do that's so important and valuable. So as I talk to women over the years, I realized that many women would say things like, my mom is my best friend, or now that my parents are older, I'm the mom now, I'm mothering my mother, or I'm the parent for my parents. And yet, as they continued to describe their relationships and tell their stories, I realized, no, you're not. You're not your parents' parent. You know, if you are like me, you're a millennial generation, or you're someone Gen X, and your parent is a baby boomer generation or the greatest generation, you've never lived through what they lived through. You've never lived through the social and political climate that they've lived through, or the life experiences, the wars, the presidents. You're not your mother's mother. And so it came to me really that what we were describing was things with more nuance, like care, intimacy, closeness, disclosure, privacy, safety, comfort. But it was hard to describe each of those individual dimensions. So we would say the nearest kind of role that we could. So we would say I'm mothering, or, you know, we're best friends, or things like that. What that does is it makes everything women do seem like a maternal behavior. And I found it's so important that we call the things that we do by the right name. And so when I'm caring for my parents or interacting with them, I am daughtering them. And that daughtering may look different in my 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s as I age, as my parents age. But it's so important to call it daughtering because it elevates the importance of that role and the beauty of that role in our lives. So you also asked about sons. And I think that sonning is incredibly important. You know,
that.
I've learned so much from my husband as he has cared for his mom. You know, his dad passed away and his mom, you know, has some medical needs. And I've learned so much from watching him. But there's a critical divide between men and women. And it's that men are not as expected to turn towards this family role. Men are often championed for their individuality, for their career accomplishments, individual accomplishments. Men are often allowed a lot of individual and private time for, you know, activities or friendships or travel or pursuing their own thoughts and their own dreams. Whereas women are rarely expected to use that extra time, extra in quotes, to do family things. And so the dichotomy here isn't that we're bashing men or saying aren't doing it. And I think generationally more and more sons are doing family labor. But a lot of times when men do things in families, we just clap for them and say, what a family man, what a great dad, what a great son. The exact same behavior in a woman is expected, is natural, is an obligation. And so there's just a disconnect there between sons and daughters still in our culture. And I think it's changing over time, but we're not quite at the equality level yet.
Yep. And yeah, I think the same can be said, you know, in a bit of the reverse, but you know, I do hear, you know, some of my guy friends occasionally say, oh, you know, my wife is out tonight, so I had to babysit the kids.
Well, yeah.
You're parenting, you know?
Yeah.
You're not babysitting.
Yeah. Well, and you bring up a great point where we start to talk about the nuances of language. You know, when a mother is parenting her kids, she's mothering her kids. But if you hear about a man who is fathering a child.
That's yeah. I never thought about that.
Typically in English mean parenting. It means procreation, right? And so it brings up these sort of differences in the language. And what that tells us is that we don't have the language that's appropriate to describe those nuances, the differences. Because I think many men love being a father. They love fatherhood, but mm-hmm. then we're not saying I'm fathering my child, right?
Yep. Yeah, you're
great
right.
Great job fathering your child, because then we're like, oh, because we've gone into this sort of other realm of sperm donor, you know, rather than caregiving or caretaking. And you think those reveal to us what we value in a society. What do we value men for? What do we value women for? And what is expected and what's unexpected in our roles? You know, being a daughter is something, we're a daughter the day we're born. We're a daughter the day we die, even though our parents have passed. And we can find beauty and honor in that role when we elevate it to the forefront and talk about the intricacies of it.
That's terrific. That's great. So where do you think these expectations come from? Are they shaped more by family dynamics or by broader societal norms?
Yes and yes. So, you know, one thing I think that's kind of cool is that family to family, we're all doing daughtering a little bit differently, just like we're doing friendship differently, or we're doing our marriages differently, you know, group to group. And yet we can see some universal trends or norms in that. So I think that we can notice that while family to family, we may be slightly different. Perhaps your family goes on an annual cruise together and my family does 4 barbecues a year. You know, those are different, and yet they're still holidays or events or gatherings. We can see that many of those things are guided by our society in general. And so I think for Americans, it's kind of interesting for us to notice how the spirit of capitalism often pervades how we do family. And what I mean by that is we have sort of an economic sense of you did for me, now I owe you. Or I've invested this much, so now I have to go and replenish it in this way. And so we kind of leaks into our thinking about the way that we do family.
That's interesting. It almost becomes transactional. Sorry to cut you off, but that's interesting.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. And then what I notice, though, is then some people hate that. You know, we'll have a parent say, well, I don't want you to come around because you think you have to. And the child, the adult child, you know, you're in your 40s or 50s, and you're like, well, I have to, but I also want to. Like, two things can be true at the same time. And in a way, it's just really a mindset of plussing and minusing what we give and take in a relationship. And I think sometimes what, you know, part of the goal of this discussion is that we're not seeing that daughters and daughtering is diminishing our bank account, you know, our family bank account. And what women want is some recognition, some thanks. It's not like we want to stop doing daughtering. We just want to maybe adjust that account a little and get a little bit of more notice on it. And then as daughters, we have to move past the pain point of how hard it is and also start looking at what's beautiful about being in a family. What do I enjoy? What do I appreciate? What benefits do I get from being a member of a family?
Sure. No, that's great. So what are some examples of daughtering that people might not even realize essentially count as caregiving?
Yeah, so I think caregiving is such an interesting term. You know, in the research world, we think of caregiving, the term caregiving, as when someone is caring for an older, like an elderly or an ill individual. And so a lot of times I think of daughtering across the lifespan as caring, as care and caring, but not caregiving. And so caregiving, when a daughter starts to take care of her elderly or ill parents, that's kind of an obvious sign of when a woman is doing daughtering. But we also want to notice well before that, when care provisions and connecting behaviors are occurring that are not necessarily as easily acknowledged. And so some examples, you know, I like to talk about daughtering in 4 categories. And that's the acting, thinking, feeling, and being. So when we're acting like a daughter, pretty much everybody can notice, right? This is like at the wedding when we bring our parents up and they light the candle, and you know, or if we call our parent, or if we bring them a gift, or we schedule, you know, and plan a retirement party, and we're acting like a daughter by really making these visible displays. But there's also thinking, feeling, and being a daughter. And those are the invisible ones because they're happening in our mind and in our heart. And if we don't narrate the amount of effort that's taking, then other people don't know that we're doing it. So an example of thinking work or cognitive labor might be thinking ahead, like, okay, this year I'm taking, this is an example from my own family. This year I'm taking a family vacation with my in-laws, but next year I'm taking a family vacation with my parents. That means we need to get this amount of money ready. We all need to clear our work schedules or our doctor schedules or our school schedules to join in together. And then I am thinking about family pictures. I'm thinking about hotel visits. So I'm really thinking a lot in order to plan or prepare something, or I'm even removing roadblocks before we've run into them. You know, so we're not running into a wall because I thought about it and fixed it. So that's kind of the, some of the an example of thinking work. Emotion work or feeling work is when daughters manage their own or others' emotions. So let's say I'm going to go to a holiday gathering, July 4th, and I know my brother is going to come and just cause a thing. So before the event ever happens, I'm calling him, I'm calling his wife, I'm trying to make sure that they understand how to behave. And that's not for them. That's for my mom. That's for everyone in the family. So it's a form of daughtering by doing sibling work. And I'm in advance doing this emotional work and talking. And then when the day comes, I'm monitoring. I'm monitoring that. I'm trying to be the emotional barometer in the room. Sometimes I call myself the cruise director. You know, I'm noticing like, who is where and who needs what and who needs to calm down and who needs a little conversation in the bathroom for a minute so we can get ourselves together. And then the next day, I may need to take a 3-hour nap because I drained my emotional battery, but I was grateful to do it as a gift for the family. And then the last kind is the being work or identity work. And I think this is particularly salient for people who are not able to be around their parent. Either you live far away or your parent has passed or you're not connected to them. How do I represent being a daughter even when no one's around? How do I represent our family legacy, our traditions, the generations of our lineage? How do I train the next generation in how to be like our family? And that's a form of daughtering, is carrying on the customs, the traditions, the name, the legacy of our family.
Sure. No, that's fascinating. I hadn't thought about it in that multidimensional perspective, you know, quite the way that you just kind of unfolded it. But how do you think daughtering can shape a woman's identity? You know, I guess the bigger question might be, what impact does it have on her mental health?
There's a wide variety of answers to that, you know, and I think that one of the first things is we need to be aware of how much we're expected to give and how much we're giving to our family, to our extended family, to our parents, and or to our siblings or cousins or aunts or uncles or grandmother in order to please our parents or keep everyone connected. So a woman's identity is greatly shaped by her daughtering role, in part because even as we're children, we're learning and we're watching. This is how a good woman behaves. This is how a well-behaved daughter behaves. And so we're seeing these patterns and these scripts over decades and feeling like I have to do that too in order to be loved and accepted and to play my necessary role, to fulfill my investment, right? That they invested in me. I have to be able to give this back to them. And so that seeps into your identity because it's like, well, how much time do I have for work, for career, for community building, for neighboring? How much do I have to give to myself individually? How much do I have to give to a partner, a marriage, to children? And so ultimately, the amount and the ways that we think about doing daughtering change who we are fundamentally in these other spaces in our lives because our resources are not unlimited. You know, they're finite. We only have so much battery, so many hours, so much money. in each day or in each year. And so what can happen is if women are overextending themselves in this area of daughtering or in multiple areas, she can start to feel guilty. She can start to feel stressed. All of those things impact a woman's mental health, her well-being, her physical health. And I think that part of the problem is we just don't know where the line is. We don't know where the goalpost is. Like, what is good daughtering? No. What is a life well lived? What will make my mom or dad happy? And I need to aim at that, what I think is right and what they think, you know. And then I need to save some energy and resources for other areas of my life where I want to grow and invest and become a good person.
That is a lot of pressure to take on, and what I say take on purposely, because, you know, it's, yes, society probably thinks it, but I think people probably thrust it on themselves as much as anything. And it's, I guess, in one way, noble that they're feeling that and that they're taking on that responsibility, but it's also, something that for their own mental well-being, they need to release. Does that make sense at all?
Yeah. I think it's so interesting to assign a word like noble, because we do, I think, value and see women's work as important and special. At the exact same time, it's common, it's banal, it's everyday, it's tiny, it's micro movements. And actually, that's the part that makes it so difficult to figure out, well, how do I change it? Because it's not just one big, special, award-winning event a couple of times a year. I don't know. I'm wondering, do you see that in your own life with the women that you know and the daughtering that they do?
That's a really good point, because I think, so much of it can seem mundane, everyday, whatever you want to call it, when in fact, that is as important as any other, duty in life. So, that really is a good way to put it. Or, important to think about, I should say.
Yeah, it's like if there's like a fountain near you and you see all these people and every day somebody comes and they put one penny in the fountain, and they're just making a wish or they're just doing something. Well, over time, whoever owns the fountain is like, I'm a millionaire because so many pennies add up, but we don't see 100 million pennies in the fountain all at once. And I think daughtering is kind of the same way. We're daughtering every day. I'm thinking about my mom every day. I'm planning. I'm, organizing. I'm removing roadblocks. I'm talking to people. Even if I'm not talking to her, I am making moves. And then on top of that, I am then having these spaces where I see my mom, I see my dad, and I basically build up capital with them. I live a couple hours away from my parents, so I don't get to see them in person. So I do phone calls, I do Instagram messages, and we send texts. We have group texts and individual texts, And I think of each of those as like a penny in the fountain. And so for me, being a good daughter is just making sure I'm getting by the fountain and putting pennies in every time. And each one of those isn't special. It's not $1 million check each time. But as long as I stay consistent and keep doing that, that's how I feel like a good daughter. Another family or another daughter might feel totally differently or do it differently or feel like good daughtering is showing up on my mom's birthday, or good daughtering is paying my mom's electric bill every month. And each of us gets to decide. But I think there's so much normalcy that we tend not to see each of those pieces as individually special, important pieces of being a daughter and making a life well-lived and a relationship that works.
That's great. Those are beautiful sentiments. So, related to that, we do hear the phrase eldest daughter syndrome a lot. Is that actually a real dynamic? And does the caregiving role always tend to be filled by the eldest daughter? Or does it fall into the lap of whoever's the most responsible, who has the most spare time, who may be the physically closest?
Yeah, you have good instincts there. In general, the research says that when our parents need caregiving in their elderhood, it's often the geographically closest child, male or female, and it's also related to who has the financial ability. So if one child has the ability to be retired, or they have a part-time job, or they can leave work to go be with their parent to do something, that's a financial privilege, then they're going to be doing it. Whereas another one of the adult children may be like, I live across the United States and we're drowning in debt and we've got six kids in college and we can't do much, you know? So, but with caregiving, a lot of the research that we have is mainly focused on the tasks aspect. Again, the physical face-to-face, the showing up, the driving, the food, the medicines. And part of, I think, what helps us to acknowledge is, what do our siblings do that's in one of those other categories that's invisible? And maybe I wasn't giving them credit, or maybe they didn't know they could be showing up in this other super helpful way that isn't just visits and money. And so when I think of eldest daughter syndrome, what I know is that the research says there's not a causal relationship, meaning just because you're the eldest doesn't mean you will end up doing the most. At the same time, I'm a researcher who believes people. And when they tell me their story, I think, that sounds real. If you're telling me it's real to you, I believe it. And so when women say, I'm having this eldest daughter syndrome, which means as the oldest, I feel the most responsible. And they often feel responsible for their siblings. That's not just the same as just the daughtering, right? They're saying, I'm burnt out because I've been doing it my whole life long. So it's often related to some childhood experiences too. And they're saying with eldest daughter syndrome, nobody is giving me credit. Nobody's noticing how hard I try. And the harder I try, the less they do. And it just compounds until I have a mountain and I'm so burnt out. I just want to quit. I just want to do nothing and just like, see you later, people. See how you do without me. So I listen to those experiences, those pain points that women are sharing. And my response to that, and a big part of what I talk about in my book, Good Daughtering, is how do we calibrate what I'm doing, what others are doing, then decide what do I want to do more or less of, and then make the moves with our siblings, with our family members, with our parents to shift the dynamics with the ultimate goal of trying to hold on to this family life, because family life is good without being burnt out, without being overused and abused and taken for granted. Finding ways to partner with our siblings by communicating better with them what our life is like and what we're experiencing. And then noticing times when I need to pull back so that somebody else can learn how to move forward. And so it's a long process, but it's a doable process.
Sure, sure. That's fascinating. So how can daughters begin to recognize and validate the work that they're already doing? What have you seen in your, experience, your academic work?
Yeah. First, I mean, get the book, right? Yep. Because
we'll be sure to include a link to the book accompanying the podcast. Thank you for that.
Yeah. What I noticed is that most women are not counting. They're not calibrating or calculating all that we do. So I have activities at the end of every chapter that help you count up or calculate how much you're doing, because we're tending not to give ourselves enough credit for all the ways, especially the invisible ways that we're daughtering. The same then can probably be said for what our siblings are or are not doing. And when we start to kind of see the matrix, as you will, you know, and we notice more stuff, then we can start to manage those things in ways that we weren't before. We can also acknowledge we're not stuck in this family pattern. I don't have to do daughtering exactly the way my mom did. You know, I will say in my own family dynamic, that's something we've been working on, because my mom was this wonderful, beautiful daughter to her mom, but her family had a single mom and poverty and some difficult things that then don't apply to the next generation down. So I'm not going to do daughtering the way she did, but she has a bit of an expectation that I will. And so we have to kind of push and pull against that tension by communicating. And I think those that many people avoid those types of communication because it is a little bit like sandpaper. But if we know I'm moving the family forward, I'm growing us, I'm becoming more efficient and effective and healthy with my time and energy, then we allow ourselves to be okay with difficult conversations. You know, I don't think a daughter's goal is to always make everything smooth and everything happy for her parent. Sometimes the greater goal calls for a bit of friction.
Great point. That's, I can certainly see where that sometimes can lead to a better, more effective result, even though it can be a little painful getting there sometimes. But so this is a question that every Roundtable Talk guest gets. What are you looking forward to, Dr. Alford, as you age?
I'm excited about aging. I'm looking forward to so many things. But one of the things I have intentionally worked on with my young children who have just become, they're currently 16 and 18. So right on the cusp and the entrance to adulthood, I have spent a lot of time teaching and training them what I expect from them as son and daughter in adulthood. So I am looking forward to seeing how they emerge into that, how they morph that, how they push back against that, and how they do sonning and daughtering to me once they are in adulthood. So I think as a person in my 40s, I'm really excited to see what my adult children are like and how we can have sort of a beautiful, interdependence on one another, while also letting them have independence and them letting me have independence and be who I'm going to be. And so that's like a downward looking role. Whereas the upward looking role, I look to my own parents and think I am excited to continue being there for them. And my goal is that they feel loved and that the way that I demonstrate that changes with each context over time. But I am grateful to have the opportunity to continue to show that to them.
You know, I love that. You talked earlier, and I really like that analogy of putting pennies in the fountain. And that really is all about love. It's about making sure that they feel that connection and that warmth and that you actually do care about them, even if it's a phone call. I mean, my father passed away a decade or so ago, lived in North Dakota. I live in Pennsylvania. I would talk to him every single day. And it could be a five-minute conversation, but it's just so important to make sure that they know, I'm an only child, but make sure that they know that you care and that you're thinking about them. And I just thought that was important and so easy to do. And it wasn't an obligation as much as it was, I looked forward to it. And I missed that when, after he passed. But
yeah, it's just a reframe, right? You know, something can be an obligation and a privilege at the same time. And I think that if we're able to reframe our lives in terms of that gratitude, like when our parents are alive, but they need us, saying things like, you know, this is hard work, but I'm grateful I have the financial or career or personal flexibility to provide it, or the geographic flexibility or whatever. You know, two things can be true at once. And I think that is such an important thing for us to lean into, because I hear from so many parents, well, I don't want them to do it if they're just doing it out of obligation. And it's like, hey, they are doing it out of obligation and love and desire, and it costs them something.
Yeah.
It's all true at the same time.
You know, I've told other friends who have aging parents, or I mean, everybody whose parents are still alive, their parents are aging, of course. But, I tell them, if they have to get into a situation where they're having to spend more time, not that they're begrudging or feeling badly about it, but, I always say you'll never regret that. And I don't say this part, but you might regret if you choose not to do it, but you'll never regret doing that sort of thing. So I'm curious, you mentioned I think you said both of your kids are teenagers, right?
Yeah.
So do they realize that is this Dr. Alford, teaching them about daughtering and sonning, or is this just mom kind of helping, you know, nurture them. So, I mean, do they reject some of that? Are they typical teenagers, or do they somewhat embrace it? I just have to ask.
I mean, you know, I think we have an extremely healthy relationship I'm really grateful for, which has a lot to do with the dynamics of generations past and how we've changed things in our family system over time. But probably until this past year, it's just been mom talking. But then as the book came out, they've also seen my professional career, and, you know, they walk by as I'm doing podcasts and they hear that sort of professional voice that I'm using. And the book came out, and my son, who's a senior in high school, he said, I'm going to read it. I want to read the paper version. And so he would send me pictures of him reading it at school, of course, you know. And so he actually finished the book yesterday, and he sent a picture to the family group chat. And then today he was like, I need you to sign my book. I was waiting until I read it, and I want to read it. You know, I want you to sign it for me. And so we've had some conversations that lean more into academic and theoretical. Now that he's read the book, which my younger child hasn't yet, you know, and that's okay because she's 16. And so there's still a lot of time, I think, before I would expect her to behave like an adult and do some of these things, you know. But besides that, my children are aware that I'm always pointing out communication. And I think that comes from my mom. My mom had some trauma in her childhood and her family. And then when she was an adult, she went and became a marriage and family therapist. So in my adolescence, she began doing a lot of talking about talking. See how these people are talking, see how your grandmother's talking, see how the TV, the people are talking to each other. And so we were doing a lot of talking about talking, this meta communication, so that I would become aware of how people relate to one another. So for me, that's a normal part of just life, is talking about talking. So my children have always had me pointing out, hey, when your friend says this, you know, some of that is because of this pain or their fear or whatever. And they realize that not every parent does that. Not every family is talking about talking. And as I did the research on daughtering, it became very important to me to think, teaching my children daughtering and sunning, it has to be taught, not caught, at least in this household. I don't want them to guess at what I want from them. And they're not expected to do it yet until they're independent adults out there on their own. But once they're out there, I want them to know, here's what I'd like in terms of phone calls, visits, money, holidays, presents. And also, here's what I don't want and I don't care about. So please don't let somebody influence you that I care about that. And that has been really important to me, to give them very specific messaging that they can rely on.
That's amazing as a parent to have a tool like your book to communicate that ahead of time. I love that.
Yeah. I think that sometimes we don't realize as parents, we're trying to give our kids the world, but by giving them the world, it's so vague. It's so open. You know, we say anything's possible, and there are opportunities where we can say, hey, I want you to know, I don't care about that. I don't like that. Like, I don't need that. So if you hear from your roommate that they need to visit their family 12 times a year, come home once a month, that's great for your roommate and their family. I'm great for them. In our family, I don't need that from you. I would like FaceTime calls while you're getting ready and brushing your teeth. I would like one vacation a year forever with your spouse, with your kids. That's just what I want. And so I want you to know what I do want and what I don't want. I don't care for my children if I pay your cell phone bill till forever. I'll pay it, especially if you use that to call me. Other parents might say, you're 18, you're on your own. Each of those is a valid choice, but we need to communicate to our children what we want from them and what we don't care about.
Great advice. So, you know, we've been talking about this or alluding to it, but daughtering often starts long before the parent needs care. It's a role that shows up in small ways early on and then grows over time. How do you see, you know, from your experience, that daughtering changes as the parent ages and the roles really start to shift?
Yeah, you said that so well with the idea of shift. You know, in my book, I talk about the kinship shift, which is if I'm a daughter and I'm 20, what my mom and or dad need from me may be very little. You know, they're career people. They're in charge. They've got money. They've got health. They've got power. They've got agency. But by the time I'm 40 and they're 70, there's different emotional needs. There's different time needs. There may be different financial needs. And what daughters should be aware of is that our relationship, you know, the sort of the places where we're at shifts over time. And we may take on more of the alpha role, as in being the more in charge person. That doesn't mean, again, that I ever become my mother's mother or that I become my dad's parent, but it does become sort of daughtering plus plus. Daughtering has to change. It has to grow and it has to morph. And our parents' parenting will diminish and their agency and their choices and their abilities will diminish. We're still, they're the mother, I'm the child. But our abilities and the way we handle those diminish. And I think that for many of us in whether it's 30s, 40s, 50s, sometimes that smacks you upside the head. And you're like, whoa, I didn't know we were here already. But looking back, I can see the ways my parent had more need. And I wasn't quite ready for those dynamics to change. But if we talk about that more as a society, with our friends, with our peers, what do your parents need? What do my parents need? What am I, you know, what are all my friends doing or not doing? I think we become more comfortable with it. And we have to understand that as an adult child, when our parents need more, there's a grieving process to that. It's hard. It's not always what we want to do. We wish that we could go backwards, but you know, that's like I tell my teenagers, you will long for childhood, right. Yep. But all they want is adulthood, well said. You know?
Yep.
And so the number one thing we can do is notice it's always changing. Those dynamics are changing. So not to be caught unawares, because they're changing right now. They have been changing and they will keep changing to the point where a lot more of your attention is necessary.
Sure. Indeed. Well, related to that, what role, from your perspective, do daughters typically play in conversations and decisions about care, senior living, those kinds of topics? And yeah. I will say, we work with a lot of senior living organizations, and you know, we often talk that it's generalized, but generally, the adult daughter, the eldest daughter, is the one who is having those conversations, particularly as more care is needed. To your point earlier, it might be a child that has more resources or is closer, but you know, broadly speaking, it often becomes that eldest daughter. But so the question is, what role do they typically play in conversations and decisions about those sorts of things?
Yeah.
Do you see?
Yeah, daughters, and I mean, it's someone in the adult child area is needed, right? It's not typically the neighbor. It's not usually the person's sibling or parent. It's the adult child who's doing that. And whether it's the daughter, which again, daughters are more likely to live near their parent than the son is. And we could ask, why is that? But it just is. Okay. You know, it's yep. to some degree.
Not right, wrong, or anything else, but it just
yeah,
is.
Yeah. We find, so women find themselves in that position. And what can be really startling about it is that we've never talked about it before, or we are unsure, what is our parents' financial situation? What is our parents' desire for living in senior living or communal living or having in-home care? And I think some of the things that we're learning as we go, and I'm seeing more women and families discuss this, is just more conversation about what do you like, what do you not like, and what am I willing to do and unwilling to do, so that doesn't surprise mom or dad when that comes around. So I think it's a big, big role for daughters. And it can feel very stressful if we just keep putting it off and thinking, well, I'll have the conversation when the moment comes. And instead thinking, I can have that kind of conversation in tiny ways over time, starting now. And actually, while that's a little bit uncomfortable today, it's going to provide greater relief over time.
Great point. So when families and daughters do start making decisions about care, it can bring up a lot of mixed emotion in families. different options among siblings, sometimes even tension or resentment. Why can these decisions sometimes create tensions within families, do you think?
Yeah. Well, and I'll tell you, I've been through this, you know, with my in-laws. And there was a lot of tension. And when we had to make care decisions and facility decisions, first of all, I felt like I'm way too young for this. You know, I think when I had to make the very first decision like that, I was 31 or 32. I'm like, this is not fair. Nobody else that I know who's 32 who has a five-year-old child is doing this. Now, that wasn't true, but it felt true. And it felt very lonely and isolating. And it felt like I just was so unsure of where to get the resources or what podcasts to listen to. And so I think sometimes when we feel tension within ourselves about these transitions, then that can overflow onto the people we know and love the most, because they're the safest place for that to bubble over. But another reason why we have tensions within families is because we often only see one type of help as helpful, and a lot of the invisible forms of help are not acknowledged. So let's say I live near my parent and I need to make a decision about them moving to a different community. Well, I also then have to go on the visits. I have to write the checks or fill out the forms. I have to move my parent in. And my sibling who lives in California, in my mind, I'm like, they're not helping or they're not doing their fair share. And I think that goes back to the economic American Absolutely. Mindset that everybody has to do a fair share and everybody has to do their work, but also we tend to only notice that active, close face-to-face part of the daughtering and not noticing the things that people can do from far away, which is emotional support for me and or my parent, financial support, or noticing what each member of our family has to give or not give. Cause you know, maybe my little sister doesn't have any time or money to do this because she's 7 years younger than me and has little bitty kids or is in school or, you know, and so everything isn't going to be fair because we're not all in exactly the same place in life. But I think we can reduce the tension by sharing what's painful, what the pain point is, and what would be helpful if our sibling gave it. What would be helpful is more phone calls, more questions, more money, more visits, or, you know, sending care packages, whatever it is that you think would be helpful. And trying to find partnership with your siblings and family members rather than constantly noticing the divide.
Sure, sure. So I guess related to that, but perhaps, coming at it from a different perspective, you know, we often talk about one default daughter, but have you seen cases where multiple daughters step into that role and it creates conflict or overlap?
I do think there are lots of families where multiple daughters are doing it, or multiple daughters-in-law, or sons and, you know, multiple people. And then there's maybe not help, but there's commentary from the aunts and the uncles or even a grandparent or even the adult children of the adult children. Right. It's important to say it's not like this is just solvable, like I can say one quick thing and it's solvable. But I really believe that we get closer to alignment when we share our stories, when we narrate, what am I doing? What am I thinking? What's bothering me? What's upsetting me? I also think that many of us find so much tension in these times of caregiving and changing houses and spaces because we've never confronted these topics before, because we didn't want to talk about them when we were in our 20s or 30s or 40s. And all of a sudden now we're like, the situation is acute and I have to make a decision in this exact moment, and I don't know what to do, and I don't know what they want to do, and I don't have money to do it, and I don't have partnership doing it. And then it's more than just this parent situation. It's all of those dynamics coming to a head. And with so many other family issues, we don't do that. We don't wait till the last minute. You know, I have a kid who's about to go to college. We're not going to wait till July 31st and decide where he's going to college. You know, we've been talking about college for years. We've been planning financially. We've been making applications and getting helpers. And the same can be helpful and be true for care decisions.
Sure. Great point. So we have talked a lot about the mental and emotional toll that doddering can take. At what point does it become too much, and how can women start to reset those expectations?
Yeah, each of us, I like to think, has a battery. You know, it's like our cell phone battery. And when we see the battery full, that's after a really good night's sleep and everybody was safe and protected, you know. And then sometimes our battery is really drained. And so what can often happen is we don't realize we're using, it's like using your phone every day and starting every day at 30%. Well, nobody does that. You charge your phone overnight so that you're starting the day at 100%. But with doddering, we're not always giving ourselves that luxury or that recap.
Great analogy.
And we're starting low, and then we're wondering, why do I feel so cranky about or resentful or overwhelmed or burnt out? And it's because our battery's running low, and there's only a few ways to reset that battery. And that's time and support and distance and taking time off. And I think just so many of us women are just not sure what's enough. What is good enough? What is a good daughter? What's a good life? How will I know if I'm a good person? And it takes us setting the bar for ourselves and deciding, what do I think is a good life? And many of us have had to reconcile that, like in a marriage, you know, what do I think is a good marriage? What is enough together time or date nights or vacations or cuddle time? Like, you have to set that, and then you can operate once you've decided what you think is enough. We need to do that for ourselves as daughters as well. If I can only go visit my parents 4 times a year, then I can't beat myself up for not getting there 6 times a year. I already know the battery, the resources, the context, the age of my children, my finances, my geography, my mental ability is 4 times a year. So I'm only gonna hold myself to that standard. So there's a lot of internal work, I think, to do to try to avoid burnout. And so much of it just starts with recognition. And then the next part of it starts with, what do I personally think is worthy? And I'm going to allow myself to be a worthy human being who doesn't have to just strive and hustle all the time to earn love and worthiness in this family.
That's a really important perspective. Thank you for sharing that. I love that. So what does it look like to set healthy boundaries? You know, how can daughters, really support their parents without becoming overwhelmed, resentful, or even consumed by the role?
Yeah. So you kind of, just like if we're playing a sport, you got to know where's the goal line. You know, if you're an inch shy of the goal line, you don't score. If you get over the goal line, you score. We have to set a goal line. And so what I encourage women to do is set a rubric or set expectations for what you can give, what you financially can give, what you time-wise can give, what your emotional battery allows for. And you kind of have a rubric. Now, I'm a professor, so I'm always giving students rubrics so that they'll know before they turn in the assignment how to get maximum points. So I urge women to do that. And then once you have a rubric, like if I did everything like this, I'd be an A++ daughter. So create a rubric and then aim to be a B+ daughter. Because a B+ daughter would still be a pretty dang good daughter. You're Absolutely. Passing the class, you're giving a lot, but you're reserving some too. And when you reserve some, it's for you personally, it's for your marriage, it's for your children, it's for your work, it's for your community, or you're reserving some so that you'll have a little bit, you know, in the bank, in the investment, for when the crisis moment comes up. So we can't be giving at our max all the time and then wonder why the crisis knocked us for a loop. You know, we've got to have a bank account with reserves ready. So that means I have to not do everything in the moment just because I can. And so I say to women a lot, you know, just because you can see what needs to be done and you'd be good at doing it, doesn't mean it's yours to carry. So we have to practice boundarying ourselves before the crisis comes. We have to practice letting our siblings learn how to step up by stepping back. And we need to do that sooner rather than later so that we can get to that healthier dynamic before the big crisis moment comes.
Sure. So why do you think it's so hard for women to set those boundaries or ask for help?
In general, in every area of our lives, women feel like we have to strive and hustle and prove ourselves. And wow. and whether that's in the workplace or in our marriage or in our parenting or in our community, women often have this feeling like they want more from me, they need more, or for me to be worthy, I have to do more. And so it's a very challenging thing to combat that cultural narrative here in the daughtering space as well. And I think this is a place where the parent could be helpful. So if the parent is able to say, girl, you're fine. You're doing enough. No, don't come. Don't visit. Don't bring that. Don't spend that money on me. It can be helpful to let the children off the hook because we need someone in our lives who says, you don't have to strive. You don't have to hustle. You don't have to constantly be on to be worthy of being a member of this family.
That's great. So what's next for you, both in your work and in continuing to explore the idea of daughtering? You've achieved so much. You know, you're obviously a professor. You earned your PhD. You've published this book. What's next?
Yeah, I'm delighted to keep doing the research. I have several research projects in the works and academic publications coming out. I've got speaking events coming up like at Yale next month and some convention centers. So I'm really delighted. I'd love to be speaking to any groups that want to do that. But I think that, you know, one of the biggest things that I have in the works is writing out the theory of daughtering from a social scientific perspective and saying, how does this exist at the intersection of gender and sociopolitical and economic and family lives? And where's that nexus? And kind of writing that out and creating a paradigm for us to all understand where daughtering comes from, which helps explain the why, but then also allows us to try to understand even more contexts about it in niche and individual little ways. So scientist at heart, I'm going to keep going with that.
Love that. So last question. What have you learned that you wish you could have told your younger self?
A lot of what I've learned is that it's not about doing more. It's about being more intentional. So I guess that's quality over quantity. You know, as a daughter, as a mother, as a wife, realizing that what I thought was maybe a volumetrics approach, like if I just did more, that would be worthwhile and helpful. I've actually learned in many ways, more isn't better, but higher quality and intentional. So when I show up as a daughter for my parents, you know, they don't necessarily need a large volume of low quality time with me. They want intentional high quality time with me as their daughter, and then some with the son-in-law and some with the grandkids, but they also just want some quality time with me. Well, if I want to have that in the tank and I want to give that to them, I need to be well rested and intentional when I get to my space with them to share about my life, to let them in with intentionality. And that's a gift that I give to my parents to allow them to know me. And so that's what I think I would tell my younger self is you don't need to do necessarily so much time, but to just make sure you're being really high quality with the connection.
That's great advice. And Dr. Allison Alford, I can't thank you enough for the time. You have great spirit, great energy, a lot of great perspectives to share with those listening. So thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I'd also like to thank Dave Schaffner, our producer, and Matt Campbell, our engineer. I'm Derek Dunham, and we'll see you next time on Varsity's Roundtable Talk.